Welcome to Conversations for a Brave New World with Donna, Sonia and Cliff, where we bring you a global, national and local focus on gender, sexuality and feminism.
Hi, I'm Donna Bridges, Senior Lecturer at Charles Sturt University. This is Conversations for a Brave New World, and today we're celebrating International Women's Day. Recently, there's been a lot of media about the need to make International Women's Day more meaningful. The catchcry has been that International Women's Day is more than just cupcakes. The Women's Agenda then went on to write an article about concerns that we do something on International Women's Day and then we don't do anything again for the rest of the year. We eat cupcakes, we go to an event, but it's pretty meaningless. Timothy Smith said that if International Women's Day wants to survive, it needs to be less frivolous, more action-orientated and more serious. She said that there's a lot of hoo-ha around International Women's Day. Commitments are made, women are applauded, and then the next day we go back to the way it was. So some women are doing International Women's Day all year round. Not with the same pomp and ceremony, perhaps, but with the same desire to have an impact and make a difference for women. In regional, rural, and remote areas of Australia, Australian women's health centres are on the ground supporting women and children, improving health outcomes for women of all ages and through all life stages. Women's health centres have a long history with International Women's Day. In New South Wales, they came into being in 1973. Around the time of International Women's Day. And in 1974, the federal government granted funds on International Women's Day that year in Leichhardt. Today, I am here with Karen Boyd, the centre manager of the Central West Women's Health Centre, which is based in Bathurst, and Paula Carl, generalist counsellor and group facilitator. Welcome, Karen and Paula. Thank you very much for being here. Karen, my first questions are for you. What is a women's health centre and what kind of services do you provide?
Well, I think women's health centres play a very important part. And we at Central West Women's Health Centre are one of 21 women's health centres scattered throughout New South Wales. We are run by women, for women. We've got a board of seven women from a broad cross-section of the community with diverse backgrounds. We're a staff of 10, and we provide generalist counselling, child and adolescent trauma counselling, health promotion. We facilitate a number of events and activities throughout the year that really support women, empower women to make really informed choices to improve their lives.
And across the past three decades, we've moved from a victim-centred way of looking at things to some kind of recognition that there are political, social, economic, cultural forces, and all of these, called the social determinants of health, impact women's health, particularly vulnerable and disadvantaged women. How can that happen though, Karen? How can political determinants actually affect the health of an individual?
Well, I think political decisions affect women, particularly, Paula and I were discussing this morning, particularly when women aren't involved or consulted in legislation and law. And we were discussing both the Labor Party and the Liberal Party and the historical decisions that have been made and how those decisions are affecting women now.
Yeah, well, some of the work that I do individually and with groups is with older women, for example. Women, I'm in my 50s now, and we're sometimes referred to as the sandwich generation. And so the sandwich generation is busy trying to be a parent still, in often difficult and very rapidly changing environment. But we're also have the burden of care for older people in our community. You know, as a student of social work at CSU, I looked into this, so I was very curious. And I discovered that, and this is a great example, I think, during Hawke and Keating government, they realised that we were going to have a population crisis around this time. They realised that our population was ageing, and that there wouldn't be enough services and taxpayers necessarily to fund what was going to be required. And what has happened is that those forecasts about our ageing population and how they would be living and how long were actually underestimated, because we've had such medical advances as well. So people are living longer and they're living with greater levels of disability. But when they did the planning around this, they planned assuming that women would be in the unpaid workforce doing the caring. So there was never enough budget allocation for the services that we were going to need. It was just assumed that women would be able to step in and provide that care. And of course, as somebody who's in that situation, and now also we've had lots of disadvantages with childcare, we've got lower superannuation and lower participation in workforce. We were more adversely affected by COVID. We've got more issues with the caring responsibilities. We've got a mental health crisis with our young people. And then we've also got the burden of care for our ageing parents. And it's not all women, but it's the vast majority of women. It adversely affects women. So government decisions and government policies have a huge impact on the health and well-being of an individual, and they usually adversely impact on women.
Political decisions being made, 30 years ago, is affecting women's health now.
Absolutely. Some of the women that I see, and they're exhausted. They are stressed and exhausted, and they're trying to divide their time reasonably under these enormous pressures and guilt. We really need to have a woman's voice in every policy decision in government.
That's absolutely right, Paula. And also we were discussing John Howard and some of the decisions that were made during his time.
That's right. So so this doesn't seem to be associated with any political party. This is about gender. And so both political parties need to really step up in this department. And the representation of women in Parliament is widely recognised as being a problematic situation. But what's even more problematic is that, under the Howard government, there were a lot of women's organisations that did provide advocacy and lobbying to the government that were defunded. So, for example, the Women's Electoral Lobby, which was a really key voice, was defunded under the Howard government. And also there had been a requirement in every government department for there to be equity officers and officers for women in the policy development to analyse the costs for women in these policy decisions, and those positions have often been removed. And they might have been replaced by other political mechanisms, but that separation of the public service from the government, those lines sometimes get blurred as well.
What about the other factors, social, economic, cultural, Karen?
So as you would be aware, the centre's located in Kelso, and it is a large social housing precinct within Bathurst, and it's an area of great disadvantage. 50% of the population are female, almost 9% identify as Aboriginal, 32.4% are unemployed, 20% are one-parent families, 81% of whom are female. So we deliver multifaceted programs to support women from all backgrounds to improve their health outcomes. And this is based on the social determinants of health, you know, which include factors like socioeconomic status, education, the neighbourhood and the physical environment, employment and social support networks, as well as access to healthcare. So I think this centre plays a really important part in helping women to obtain better outcomes in terms of health. Race and ethnicity, gender, sexual identity, age, disability, all of the things that we've talked about, and the geographic location all contribute to an individual's ability to achieve really good health goals and outcomes.
But the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare recognised that people living in regional areas and in the lowest of socioeconomic circumstances and compared with the higher socioeconomic areas, were 1.6 times as likely to have at least two chronic conditions, live 3 years less on average, and 30% are more likely to engage in alcohol or using illicit drugs, and twice as likely to delay seeking medical assistance because of access and affordability.
Sometimes through the life course, women are alienated by the services that we provide to in society, aren't they? So that can put them in a position where they don't want to access health care.
I think that is the real advantage of being a women's health centre, because women can come to this centre and they could be coming for any reason at all, whether it's accessing a counsellor, coming to a craft activity. You know, we do mindfulness. It could be seeing the women's health nurse. It's a safe space for women to come.
It certainly makes the centre very inclusive, doesn't it? And the theme for this year for International Women's Day is about inclusion. What other services does your organisation provide that are inclusive? And does it include being inclusive in the centre, or does it include inclusion in the community as well?
I think the first step to providing an inclusive service is to ensure that staff are suitably qualified and trained and are culturally sensitive. Whilst we only employ women, we've got women from very diverse backgrounds. You know, we've got women from Aboriginal culture, from the LGBTIQ community. We've got a broad range of ages. You know, I'm the oldest person here, and then we've got someone in their mid-20s. So I think it's really important that we reflect the community, and I think that makes the place a warm and inviting and safe environment for women.
Yeah, so getting back to International Women's Day, and you did ask how we are inclusive, not only in the centre but out in the community. International Women's Day falls on the 8th of March, but we're beginning on the 1st of March with a week-long series of events.
We'll also be encouraging and supporting people to come and commemorate the women that have lost their lives to domestic violence. So it's quite horrifying, really, and I find it incomprehensible that this is still going on, that we're losing a woman a week, roughly. And this year, it's been even more. So it's even more than one woman a week that's murdered by someone that they love or that's loved them. So we will be having the bench. We'll be purchasing a plaque from the Red Rose Foundation that works tirelessly to raise awareness and keep this at the front of politicians' minds. We will also be having a minute's silence for the women that have been affected by domestic violence.
So women's health centres have a role in preventing violence against women, don't they, Paula? Campaigning, awareness raising about the impact that violence has, as you said, not just deaths, but a daily, weekly life impact, the extent of violence, investment in recovery and healing services. So what's your role in this centre?
My role in this centre is again, first and foremost, to make sure that as a worker, I'm a safe and competent and professional worker, and that I have the resources, really great resources here, and I work with other services appropriately to support women. So part of my role is in providing a safe place for women to talk about their experiences, and then for us to work out a plan that supports them to take the actions that they need to keep themselves and their families safe. So I also do some group programs. So we know a lot more now about the impact of trauma and our bodies, the importance of supporting our body when we're working through trauma. So we do a women's walking group, and that runs on a weekly basis down around the Peace Park. It's just really beautiful with a really diverse group of women. And so that community of women supporting other women, and we just have a lovely walk around the park. We don't necessarily have a talk about anything very serious, but just knowing that there's a group of women that support you and that you're moving your body and keeping the body going is sometimes really important, and connecting with other people. We also know a lot more about loneliness and the impact of loneliness on our health. It's actually post-COVID being identified as a crisis for people in their health. So providing opportunities through our craft groups and mindfulness groups, our grief and loss groups, walking, and we're also about to embark on a very exciting community project called Rhythms to Recovery, which is looking at using drums and music as a therapeutic tool. So, and we're doing that in partnership with a range of organisations in Bathurst, so we're really looking forward to rolling that out.
That sounds amazing. So it's not just therapeutic, then, the service that you offer, it's community development.
That's right. Yeah, we're very keen to work in partnership to support everyone in the community, because we know that most of the women that I meet, they love their men. They love their men.
Of course.
They just don't love the violence.
Yeah.
They just don't love the violence. They don't love watching their children be harmed in this environment. And I'm not saying that it's all men, and I'm certainly not a man hater, which I have been accused of, far from it, because I actually see the damage that this does for men too. If we look at men's health indicators, they're in a really bad way. So we know their suicide rate is high. We know they have high rates of homelessness. We know they have problems with depression, and they have problems seeking help for those things. The current structures and the current way that we're thinking about how men and women relate to each other and how we support each other are not working for men either. Mm. This is not a great life for men. So how do we change that so that we're supporting each other and working together?
That's right. Living in a domestic environment where you are an abuser, where you are a perpetrator of violence, would be a very difficult situation to live in. I agree.
You know, a woman presents, and the first impulse is to say, we need to leave, you know, we've got to get you out of this situation. But women don't necessarily want the relationship to end.
No.
They want the violence to stop.
They want the violence to stop.
And so I guess in some circumstances we're holding women in that safe space while they make that decision, while they work through. Sometimes it's you do need to get out. We know that. But there are circumstances where it's not cut and dried, and it's not a simple decision to make.
It's not a simple decision to make. So, and for some women, they have decided that they want to leave, but they're safer and their children are safer if they stay, particularly with the level of rental crisis at the moment and the level of poverty, particularly for single parents. It's well documented. And also the risks to their own safety and the safety of their children when they choose to leave violence, the risk is actually increased for them. So it is not a straightforward decision for women to leave, but it's often the first question that is asked. Why didn't they go? Why don't we start asking, why did that man do that? And what can we do to change that?
And why didn't he go?
Why didn't he go?
And it's also the threat of having the children removed. If you don't have a home, you can't provide a roof over your children's head.
Yeah.
So it does become a child protection issue.
Well, I guess there is a lot of things to feel deeply concerned about. You know, when we pick up the newspaper, and just this morning, a woman that's been run over by a slasher, I can't conceive how you could do that to someone. But anyone, a stranger, let alone someone that you care for. But it does happen, and it has happened. So there's a lot of things to feel really deeply distressed about. But I tell you what, there's also some fantastic things to really celebrate. I love my job. Like, people ask me often, how do you do what you do for? And it is such a privilege to witness the strength and resilience and possibility that women absolutely shines through in the most horrendous and difficult circumstances at times. It is such a privilege to do the work that I do and to meet someone when they're in crisis and to support them through their journey of changing their life and the impact that then that has on the future of stopping that cycle is very powerful. So I see that happen every day. I see women do incredibly brave things. I see women do resourceful things. I work with a team of women that are the most supportive and interesting and smart, capable people. We have wonderful leadership. And so there's a lot to feel hopeful about. I see the younger women in my life stepping up and being empowered in themselves and in their sexuality and in their choices. I see them have opportunities that I would never have dreamt of at their age. And so there are a lot of things that are worrying, but there's a lot of things that we can really draw on those strengths and push forward and keep pushing. The fight's not over.
Indeed, the fight isn't over. And these are the women at the coalface in the Central West. Not just cupcakes for them, that's for sure. And it's not all about providing services when there's problems. As you heard, it's about empowering women, it's about life-affirming services. So thank you, Karen, and thank you, Paula, for being with us today.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
I'm now joined by my colleagues, Sonia Maria and Cliff Lewis. Cliff and Sonia, were you inspired by that interview?
Well, I think it was very interesting. It sparked a lot of parallels with other conversations on equality and particularly the government's role in equality. I mean, we've just come out of a referendum for First Nations people where we were asking for First Nations voices to be heard in Parliament on decisions concerning First Nations people. And one of our speakers today highlighted, you know, women should be involved in every decision in Parliament. It just made me think, well, if the very basic fact that half of our population are women and they can't have a say, then what hope does anyone else have? What hope does LGBT people have? What hope does, you know, First Nations people have? And this is not on matters that don't concern them. It's on matters that concern them.
Mm. And unfortunately, it seems to be the first thing that gets cut, like the budget for having those voices in particular areas. If there needs to be a budget cut, it seems to always come from those kind of groups where they feel like it's fat in the system rather than a necessity.
Yeah, because it's almost like a nice to have, isn't it? I think we've got that nice to have mindset as opposed to a this is just a human right of being included and having a voice in things that concern you. Another thing that really struck me was the notion of, I think the comment that women still love their husbands, but they also love their children and, you know, they don't love the violence. And it just shows such a sense of vulnerability, isn't it? Like, I feel so privileged in many ways of not being in that situation and would not know how to respond to it. You know, it makes this notion of having those voices represented all the more important because not many of us can be in that position where we understand the challenge of I need to protect my kids. I love my husband. What do I do?
I just thought the women that were providing the service, the women who worked in the centres, just did an amazing job and so undervalued. It really resonated with me how much work they put into it and how passionate they are about what they do. And, you know, in all honesty, I never knew what they did. I've been lucky enough of having had to use that service, but I'm so pleased and so thankful that we actually have that service for them.
And those services, they're not just for disadvantaged women or women in domestic violence situations. You can go there to see a community health nurse who does pap smears and things like that. And you can go there to yoga. And they have a lot going on for International Women's Day. They're having one thing a week. And by the time this airs, they'll just be on to their last couple of things.
I think it's important to know that domestic violence does affect everyone. And if you are in a situation where you're feeling threatened or need any help, there are definitely services out there like 1-800-RESPECT. So that's 1-800-737-732 Or if you're a First Nations person, 13YARN, 139276. That can definitely provide support required.
Thanks, Cliff and Sonia. It was a really interesting show, and these are the women at the coalface. These services offered are extensive and they're responsive, but it's more than that, isn't it? The women who work in women's health centres, they're passionate, focused and committed. They bring a lot of positive energy to all areas of women's lifespan. And coming up to International Women's Day, we'd like to celebrate all women and thank the women who work in women's health centres.
Thank you for listening. This show is brought to you by the Gender Network. To get involved or find out more, simply Google the Gender Network at Charles Sturt.